This is listener-supported public radio. You are tuned to KBBI Homer, AM 890. The time is 9:02 a.m., and this is The Coffee Table. I'm Kathleen Gustafson, and the topic this morning is a check-in with the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies. So let's start that check-in now. Beth Trowbridge, Executive Director, do you read me?
I do read you. Good morning, Kathleen.
Good morning. Next, Katie Gavanis, Program Director.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thanks for having us on.
Thanks for being here. Henry Riske, Wind Nature Center and Coast Walk Coordinator.
Hello, I'm here as well.
Woo, you've got quite an echo. So
I do.
And Shannon Moore, who is the school coordinator and Peterson Bay Field Station coordinator. Shannon, are you there?
Good morning, I'm here.
Good morning. So the first thing I'd like to do is check in with Beth Trowbridge, Executive Director. And if you could, I just introduced everyone, but if you could introduce people to the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies.
Okay. For people that may not know us, we've been around since 1982, and we are outdoor education and stewardship organization, and we have now five facilities that we run programs out of: our headquarters, the Wind Nature Center, the Inspiration Ridge Preserve, the Peterson Bay Field Station, and the Yurt on the Spit in the summer.
I had forgotten that Inspiration Ridge is now part of the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies.
Yeah, that's been very exciting. Last summer was the first summer that we actually started to do a few guided walks, and we're hoping that this summer we'll be, you know, doing them from the beginning of the season, you know, throughout the whole summer.
Now, I want to start with Katie Gavanis, who is the program director. And Katie, I introduced you by name and title, but could you talk a little bit about what you do at the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies? Because I want to get your take on sunflower stars.
Yeah, so thanks, Kathleen. You know, I do many things at the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies. As the program director, my biggest responsibility is to kind of oversee the programs that we have in existence, as well as new programs that we're developing, and help to make sure that they are meeting the needs of our community and of the other schools and communities we work with, and that they're building on each other in service of our mission and vision. And so that's kind of my overall role. And I do a lot with kind of hiring and training of staff as well. But a big kind of side project that I'm really passionate about that started when I was working as a naturalist over at the Peterson Bay Field Station was the sea star monitoring project, as we started to see the impacts of sea star wasting syndrome. And so that's something that many people on our team have been involved with, including Shannon and Henry, pretty heavily, but that has been, you know, a passion of mine since we started working on it. And so it's been fun to be able to continue to work on it in this new role.
Thanks. Now, the University of Oregon and the Nature Conservancy have been doing a study. They said they named sea star wasting was named in 2013. Has the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies been working and monitoring sea star wasting since that time?
Almost. So we started to notice a few odd things with sea stars in the summer of 2013, but we hadn't heard the name yet. And then in fall 2013, we saw a few articles that discuss this phenomenon of sea star wasting syndrome or sea star wasting disease that was happening in Washington, Oregon, California. And so we connected pretty early on with researchers from the Lower 48 and the multi-agency Rocky Intertidal Network, and adapted their survey protocols and started doing surveys in summer of 2014. So pretty much from the beginning. And when we started those surveys, we would occasionally see a C-star with mild symptoms of C-star wasting syndrome, or even every once in a while we saw one with severe wasting. But when we really saw the significant die-off was in late summer and early fall 2016. So we had about 2 years where it seemed to be present in a really low level, but then 2016, towards the end of the summer, was a really dramatic die-off. I was just looking back at the numbers, and in those surveys we did in August 2016, over 90% of the sunflower stars that we saw were exhibiting signs of wasting. And then we really just didn't see sunflower stars again for about 1.5 years. And then over 75% of the true stars, or also called model stars, that we saw were showing signs of wasting in September 2016. And then they also, we were seeing really low numbers of them until we got into kind of late 2017, 2018.
And Henry and Shannon, I want to make sure you know to speak up if you want to add to this conversation, because it's a little more difficult when we're all in different places. For no one can indicate to me that that they want to jump in. So just jump in. The other thing, I was reading the University of Oregon study, and they said the listing of critical endangerment or critically endangered is they're listed by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature.
Mm-hmm.
And who are they?
That's a really good question. So it's an international entity. And one of the reasons I believe that, so the Oregon State University team and the Nature Conservancy were kind of the lead researchers that compiled data from all sorts of different sources. And so data from the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies were contributed along with data from over 60 partner institutions. And so they pulled all this information together. And the reason that they took the listing to the IUCN, or one of the reasons, is that it's an important sort of statement and catalyst for being able to think about conservation actions, but it's not as automatically regulatory based as a listing under the Endangered Species Act in the United States would be. So there's more flexibility, because what there was a lot of concern about is that sunflower stars do sometimes come as bycatch in commercial or sport fisheries. All the commercial and sport fishermen I've talked to in Kachemak Bay haven't caught one in a long time, because their population seems to have declined so significantly. But there was concern throughout the range of sunflower stars that if there was an Endangered Species Act listing, that there could be heavy penalties for accidental catch in commercial or sport or subsistence fisheries. So they wanted to avoid that.
I did ask my husband about that, who longlines, and he said that for years that it opened up fishing areas in the bay that he never could use before, because he would put out 100 hooks and 90 of them would come back with a sea star on it. But that was no longer the case, so they could fish in places. And he has told me that in the last year he is starting to see them again, but that there are far fewer of them. Go ahead. I heard you take a breath.
Yeah, well, I wanted to say two things with that. One, that matches sort of what we've been seeing both formally in our surveys and informally, is there are some spots in Kachemak Bay where it seems like the sunflower stars are recovering, or there was sort of a refuge area where they were able to survive. And that's a big deal. That's very different than what they're seeing in the lower 48, and especially south of Washington State.
Oh my goodness, the Oregon study says they haven't seen one since 2016 in Mexico, and they haven't seen one in California since 2018.
Yeah, so they've pretty, and you know, down there are people doing scuba surveys as well. So it's not just that they're not seeing them on the beaches, they're not seeing them. And in other parts of Alaska and some parts of British Columbia, there are these pockets where sunflower stars still seem to be present. And in some cases, there are juveniles that are, you know, growing larger and reproducing. So there's hope for those pockets of sunflower star populations. But it's really important for us to understand where they are and kind of why and how they are able to recover here, survive here and not in other places. And so I've definitely been asking some of my commercial fishing friends as well, and hearing similar tales and observations as your partner shared, Kathleen. And I would just encourage people, if you do see sunflower stars in Kachemak Bay, let us know. And you can, you know, you could call in today and let us know. We want to know where you're finding them, or connect with us at the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies. We are trying to compile those observations. And one of the next steps after the IUCN listing is really looking at what people can be doing to help potentially recover the species across its range. And there's a lot of questions with that, but I think there'll be more research coming out in the coming years around where sunflower stars have continued to exist and why, and what that information can, how that information can help in potentially recovering the species.
Okay. Now, I am wondering, so the number to call is 235-7721 if you want to tell us about your sunflower star sightings. But and I'll make sure when we put this show up on the coffee table that we put a photograph of a sunflower star up as our, you know, when we post it, so that people can see them. Because can you describe what designates or what distinguishes a sunflower star? What does it look like?
Yeah, so they're big. They're our biggest sea star species. They can be the size of a, you know, Fat Olive's extra large pizza, so 3+ feet across. They have more than 20 rays or legs, whatever you want to call them. And they're kind of gooey and slimy. So there's a couple of other sea star species in the bay that have more than 5 rays, and they can get kind of large. Those are sun stars, which keeps it really confusing. But the sunflower stars, if you were to hold them or if you were pulling them up on, you know, a halibut hook, they're going to just sort of drape over. They're very soft. They almost look like, you know, a combination of an octopus and a sea star. And they tend to be in kind of a combination of purple and orange or pink and green colors. It's not super bright colors, but it is definitely a rainbow of colors, sort of from purple, greenish, and then some orange in there as well.
So Pycnopodia helianthoides? Is that it? Is that how you say it? Okay.
Yeah.
Now, I did want to ask about some of the reading I did told me that the sunflower stars do a lot of work helping to maintain kelp forests because they eat purple urchins, which if they are left unchecked, then they decimate kelp forests. Is that the case up here, or is that just for Mexico and California?
Yes, that's a little bit better understood farther south. Sunflower stars are voracious predators. They're the second fastest species of sea star recorded in the world. There might be one out there that's faster, but they're very fast for sea stars, and they will eat anything they can get their tube feet on, including, importantly, sea urchins. And so in Kachemak Bay, we have 3 different species of sea urchins, all of which are preyed upon by sunflower stars, as far as I know, and which do consume kelp. And so it's possible that there's that interaction where with fewer sunflower stars, there may be more sea urchins, which could have a damaging effect on the kelp forest if the urchin population gets high enough. However, it is important to note in Kachemak Bay that we have many other predatory species that feed on sea urchins, including especially sea otters. And
Right. And we have no shortage of otters.
And we have no shortage of otters. So it's possible that that's kind of keeping the urchin population in check. But no matter what, the loss of a major predator like sunflower stars is going to have some ripple effects through the ecosystem. And so that's something as well that the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies is working on with some of our intertidal monitoring projects and a number of researchers through the Gulf Watch Alaska program and the EBSCOR program are also kind of trying to, and many other researchers locally are trying to keep an eye on how intertidal and nearshore ecosystems may be changing with these fluxes in predators.
So I have 2 questions. I know I want to get on to start including the rest of the crew. First of all, the last time I spoke to 2 marine biologists from the University of Alaska Fairbanks who were down here studying, they said there was still no cause identified for sea star wasting, but that there was some scholarship out there saying they thought it was a virus. Is there still no cause identified for all of this?
Yes, that is accurate. There are a lot of theories and well-supported ideas, but there's some conflicting information. And it's incredibly difficult to study this sort of thing in species like sea stars. They are pulling water in from their environment constantly. That's how they survive. That's how they move. That's how they move nutrients around their body. So they're filled with all of these things that are in their environment. And that includes viruses and bacteria and all sorts of other stuff that's inside of them and on them, which makes it really, really difficult to pinpoint and narrow down to an individual virus or a species of bacteria. And then there's all these complicating environmental factors. And so the research that I've read recently, there's some researchers that are focused on this idea of a virus or at least a pathogen. And then there are others that are suggesting that it is more of an environmental factor and maybe due to sort of low oxygen levels right at the surface of the sea star because of sort of eutrophication of the water. So dead organic material settling down on top of these sea stars and then creating low oxygen conditions. But there's still lots and lots of questions, and there's no kind of one cause that's been determined as of yet.
And this final question is pretty broad, so answer it in whatever way you choose. For the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies, or even in just as a general question, what changes in our relationship to the sunflower star species when it becomes critically endangered?
Well, I think for us in the Kachemak Bay region, one thing that changes, and I think a lot of people were already doing this, but one thing that really changes is paying more attention to where we see them and enjoying that for ourselves, but also as much as possible, documenting it for science as well, because we are in a really unique position. We're some of the few people in the world that can still go out at a low tide and enjoy seeing sunflower stars if we happen to be in the right part of Kachemak Bay, some of those areas where the population has persisted. And so I think a big thing is, being aware of that, being grateful for that opportunity, and then also as much as possible, trying to document where those places are. And then, of course, at Coastal Studies, we always are promoting stewardship of our intertidal ecosystems. And that's especially important with a species like the sunflower star. So, make sure that you're leaving them where they are in the intertidal area. We've stopped. We have touch tanks at our field station. We don't collect sunflower stars for our touch tanks anymore. And when we do find them in the intertidal zone, we are generally looking, but we're not picking them up out of the water because we don't want to be stressing them any more than we have to. And then for the commercial fishermen and sport fishermen and charter fishermen out there, I'd encourage you. I know many people already were taking the time to try to return them carefully if you got them on a hook or a net. But I would encourage you definitely to, if you bring them on board, put them back into the water as carefully as you can, because they are a really important part of our ecosystem and they're not doing so well in many other places.
Okay, and then go ahead.
I just also wanted to take a moment, to acknowledge that these data that we've been collecting, we're not doing it on our own. Since we started, nearly 500 students and community members have helped with these surveys. And so just wanted to do a shout out to everyone who's been involved and say that we really appreciate people in the Kachemak Bay area participating in these surveys and sharing their observations with us.
Well, thanks. That's Katie Gavanis, Program Director for the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies. I understand you have to get on to something else this morning.
I'm going to stick around for a little while longer, at least.
All right. Feel free to jump in at any time. I'm going back to Beth Trowbridge, Executive Director, and everybody can weigh in on these, about the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies and how you guys have adapted over the last year, and to hear about programs at Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies. So Beth Trowbridge, can you talk a little bit about how the center has changed in the past years, the adaptations that you've had to make?
I can. But first, before I do that, I wanted to kind of give a shout out to Katie because, you know, one of the great things about the field station is that we have people there from early spring until late fall. And so being able to do these monitoring programs with students and community members and groups and staff really has allowed us to contribute heavily to these studies. I'm getting an echo.
I hear you. I'm trying to fix it on my end, but I have not been able to yet. So I just go forward, okay. Beth.
And then also just Shannon and Henry have been kind of boots on the ground to go out there in January and February and do the nighttime sea star wasting surveys in the dark and the cold so that we can have year-round monitoring. So anyway, that's been very valuable. And so what I wanted to talk about for, you know, how we've adapted this last year, I mean, it certainly, you know, has been a crazy year for everyone, all nonprofits and, you know, businesses, whatnot, I mean, everyone. But some of the ways that it affected us, of course, the biggest thing was that we didn't have any school programs last spring, which was the first time, the second time in the history of Coastal Studies since 1982. The first time was during the spring of 1989 when the oil spill happened and the boats were all on response. So that was a really kind of sad and hard adjustment for our staff to not be able to do the spring programs at the field station. But, you know, our staff was really creative and innovated, and we put together, you know, virtual programming to support teachers and parents and, you know, try to do whatever we could to get through that season. And then we, you know, spent a lot of time developing, you know, mitigation plans so that we could open our facilities and run programs in the summer. And we were able to do that. Everything was 100% outside. We had smaller numbers. You know, reached out to partners like Pier 1 Theater and the Public Library to help us to, you know, find additional spaces and additional ways to reach out to the community and have programs. So that was, you know, really great. And
also,
go ahead.
That's all right. Also, you loaned out your bus to Project Homeless Connect, right?
Yeah. So we have a van, and this is the second year that they've, you know, borrowed it to be able to transport, you know, people that want to participate in that program. So, and Howell loaned us their van since they weren't doing programs last summer so that we could have two vans to do our day camp program so that we could keep kids, you know, separated as we had to transport them from our headquarters to, you know, the Wynn or the beach or wherever they were going to go. So I really feel like, you know, kind of a silver lining to, you know, the whole pandemic thing was just that increased collaboration and partnerships that everybody in the community tried to do, you know, as well as we did have to have programs that had, you know, much smaller numbers. You know, that was part of our mitigation plan. But what our staff found was that, you know, these smaller numbers provided just greater personal connection and, you know, more intimate, you know, experience. And so there's something to be said, you know, for that too. And we, you know, we saw a lot of people from this, you know, in state. We didn't have the out-of-state travelers this summer, but it was really fun to be able to share our, you know, facilities and the outdoors with more people from, you know, the state of Alaska. So that was kind of a silver lining.
But
I will say that without CARES, without CARES Act funding through the state, the city, the community foundation, and then increased donor support, we'd be in a really different place right now. So I'm very thankful, you know, for that allowed us to be able to keep staff on and run programs and, you know, look forward to the future.
Thanks. That's Beth Trowbridge, Executive Director for the Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies, where I'm going to expand it to talk about what's coming up for the Wynn Nature Center and Coastwalk and Peterson Bay Field Station. But the first thing I want to ask about is new programs like coming up this spring and summer. You have one called Girls Reach for the Sea Stars.
I'm going to let Henry pipe in on that one.
So, Henry, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me then?
Go for it, Henry. I hear you loud and clear.
Okay. Yeah. So, inspiring girls to reach for the sea stars, we actually started up this program last semester before the winter break with schools as part of the Alaska After School Network. And the goal of the program is to increase involvement of girls in STEM, as well as through the program we feature women in that area, whatever we're focusing on that for that week. And then recently, that was designed to cover three week cycles, so it'd be a 9-week program. But we received additional funding from the Homer Foundation through a few of, through the Gooseberry and Kleps funds at the Homer Foundation, as well as some individuals in the community to actually do that same amount of time again. So we have three new 3-week sessions coming up. We're actually right in the middle of our first one. Last night, we talked with Karen Sonnen from Natural Resource Conservation Service, and she got to talk to us about how she does her work with snow, because each week has a different theme. And this right now, we're focusing on a couple of different things that are really best observed during our winter here. We're looking at snow and stars. So we're the program involves a lot of hands-on, even though it's partially virtual, it involves a lot of hands-on. So students in the program right now are monitoring snow at their homes to take a look at what the snowpack is developing like here at Homer, what that means for our environment, what it means now as well as in the spring. And taking a look, or we will be coming up soon, taking a look at some stars to look at what is the light pollution around. One cool thing about this program is that...
Oh, you mean stars in the sky. We were just talking about sea stars, and
yes.
I had sea stars in my head.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
Okay.
That makes sense. And we did, actually, one of the first, in the first cycles of this, we actually did go out and do tide pooling and do some of that sea star monitoring out on the beach here in Homer. That was actually a really popular in-person event that we did through that. This time around, we're turning towards the sky, yeah, and doing some light pollution monitoring with the stars, as well as just looking at learning some constellations. And since it is a largely digital program, we can actually have participants from all over the state. So, like, this time around, we're going to be getting light pollution observations and snow observations from people here in Homer, which, you know, could vary pretty wildly depending on where you are in and around Homer, as well as from Anchorage. So we'll get to do those comparisons, because the way it works, each the first Tuesday of each session, they get an introduction to the idea. They pick up packets, which are available at the Homer Public Library. The second week, we talk to traditional ecologic knowledge holders, researchers, people in the field with experience and knowledge on these things. And then the third week, we come back and they get to report and share on what they've been observing through their kits. So this time, they'll be talking about how the snow was developing at their houses, or what stars they did see, if they, you know, were able to identify different constellations, as well as what amount of light pollution they were able to find.
That's my question. How is the light pollution measured?
Yeah. So these are all the things we do typically don't require much fancy equipment, because they are everything that kids would really need to do these things are in those kits. You know, it has curriculum, it has materials, it has data sheets, it has it all. And so, you know, we don't have very complex equipment for these things. And so we're actually using a program and can contribute data to something called Globe at Night. And what this does is, for each section of the year, depending northern, southern hemisphere, there is a constellation. Right now, or coming up actually starting February 3rd, that constellation is going to be Orion. And so what you do at 9 o'clock at night, hopefully it's clear, you go out and you look up towards Orion. And what you do is you just compare it to a set of, I believe, 8 images. Now, if you can barely see the major stars in Orion, you got a lot of light pollution. And on that other extreme, if you can barely make out the major stars of Orion because there's so many crowding it, you have a really clear sky. So what you want to do, what they're doing is just looking up and comparing, okay, how many stars do I see alongside these major stars? And through that, we can get an idea of how much light pollution is in a given area.
Interesting. And snow, I guess, you're just measuring how much snow you get, or is anyone collecting the snow and testing the water?
Yeah. So, as in this session, what the students are doing with their snow is they are measuring the snowpack, because we just started this session last week. Obviously, there's been snow on the ground depending on where you live. So they'll measure the snowpack, tell about how much they have before, and then they're each provided with a snowboard, which sounds maybe a little more exciting than they are, because what they are is small pieces of thin plywood painted white that you set out, and you check it after each snow event, how much snow built up, you measure it, you brush it off, you put it somewhere new, and then you can tell how much snow was on the ground, how much do we get this week, how is the snow moving and changing throughout the season. And then beyond that, I got a few. Collecting a full snow sample is a little more difficult, but they are looking into and investigating snow density and how that has a major impact on, you know, we could have 3 feet of snow, but depending on how dense that snow is, it's going to have a big impact on how much water's melting out in spring. So they can check out, how much does your sample of snow actually turn into when it melts into water? They'll then be taking the pH of that with some pH strips. Yeah,